News of the Week on 88.5 KRFY, community supported radio. A little bit of a change. My name is Will Love, and both Jack and Chris are enjoying some well-deserved R&R. So maybe, unfortunately, you're stuck with me today. But to help balance things out, we are fortunate to have the reader's own and great friend of KRFY, Zach Haggett, on with us this morning to provide some insights on a few stories he's reported on in the last 2 weeks. Zach, thanks for joining us this morning. How's August treating you so far?
Oh, well, thank you for having me, first of all. And August is treating me just fine, although I'm kind of enjoying the cool weather, and my 10-year-old daughter is already listening to Halloween music. And frankly, I'm kind of there for it. So I won't be sad to see the fall weather return.
Well, we
have a ways to go.
This morning on the walk with the dogs, you could feel that chill in the air. All of a sudden, I was like, what do I have to have ready for second period today? Like, right. You know, the school brain starting to come around.
We are both wearing sweaters.
Yes, we are. We are. Exactly. So anyway, and then, because I can't do two things at once, we're very, very fortunate to have, our engineer today, on board with us, Julie. So thank you, Julie. And how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing just fine. Thanks so much, Will. Good to have you guys in.
Yeah, thank you. So, I'm pretty excited, be remiss to, not mention this, that, tonight, and, Julie did an awesome job of playing this band a little bit before, is I get to go see My Morning Jacket in Missoula. So I'm super, super excited about that. But I was just wondering, because they've been on my like top five bands I've wanted to see. So Zach, like what's a band that you haven't seen that you like, or would like go all the way to Missoula to go see?
I would go just about anywhere to see Tom Waits.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
Like anywhere.
Anywhere. Okay. All right. So the ends of the earth.
Immediate choice. All right. Tom Waits.
Okay. Tom Waits.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of another one. Nothing really comes close to Tom Waits. I mean, I'm a big Andrew Bird fan. Mm-hmm. I would see Andrew Bird in Missoula.
Yeah.
I would go to Missoula for Cosmo Sheldrake.
Okay.
May not be familiar with Cosmo Sheldrake.
Oh, no, I've heard. Yep. I'm familiar.
I don't know if I can have two more.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems greedy.
Yeah.
Just those three.
All right. So, yeah, mine would be The War on Drugs, Kurt Vile, Dr. Dog, and a band from England, Skin Shape. So those would be my other ones.
Oh, Wetleg.
Wetleg? Oh,
yeah. When you talk about a band from England, I immediately think of Wetleg, the Isle of Wight.
That was actually, they would be like six or seven right now on my list. So, Julie, what about you?
I got a throwback. Mark Knopfler.
Okay.
I would go anywhere to see him.
All right. So, anyway, if the people at the festival are listening, you've got a list of, at least three of us would go to that show.
Well, Sierra Farrell was also on my list, but she's not on my list anymore because I saw her.
Because you saw her.
And that was amazing. I couldn't believe that the festival brought Sierra Farrell here because I had been listening to her for like 2 years and I didn't think anyone knew who she was.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden here she is on like the festival's bill.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe that I was like, this is crazy. It was like a fever dream. and I got to go see her. That was great.
And it was a great concert, too.
Right? It was a great concert. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, let's get into some of the headlines, and then we'll talk to you a little bit more about some stories you've been writing the last couple of weeks or reporting on the last couple of weeks. So first up, the Idaho Capital Sun, and this was actually in the Reader, and I see it's made its way around to different publications around Idaho, because that's what the Idaho Capital Sun does, is they reported this week that immigration arrests and detentions in Idaho have sharply increased in 2025, which probably you're saying, duh. According to the story by Laura Guido, immigration and custom enforcement arrests in Idaho increased 797% in 2025 from the same time period in 2024. That data was collected from the Deportation Data Project. According to the Sun, recent laws have been enacted along with orders from Governor Brad Little requiring all state agencies to cooperate with federal immigration officials. Authorities. And in addition, Little announced an agreement between the Idaho State Police and ICE to transport undocumented immigrants from Idaho jails to federal detention facilities. I guess that's the worst of the worst, right? Like $300,000 has been committed. Do you know anything about that, Zach? Or?
Well, only what I've read from the Capital Sun and some of the national reporting, although this notion of the worst is kind of a misnomer in a lot of cases. I mean, I've seen reporting that says something like only 30% or whatever of the people who've been detained and arrested in these operations have any kind of criminal record at all.
Right.
And a lot of the convictions won't stick because there's nothing to convict them on. So I think the quota system that they've been operating under, where it's something like 3,000 arrests per day, has kind of forced some of these ICE officials to kind of like just pad the numbers,
right?
Just like sweeping people up, which, you know, is pretty chilling.
Yes.
as a concept.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess according to the Idaho Statesman, Little announced Thursday that the state police for the first time transported undocumented immigrants from a local jail to an ICE approved detention facility. Also in the news this week, Idaho wolves will remain under state control. A federal judge this week has ruled that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service must reconsider protections for gray wolves in the West, citing flawed data from states analyzing the threats faced by wolves. Despite the decision, yesterday the Idaho Fish and Game said wolves in the state will remain under state management. Idaho officials argue the population, estimated in Idaho at around 1,200 wolves, is well above the recovery goals and believe management should remain a state issue. The ruling by the judge in Montana could eventually impact Idaho, though, depending on future federal decisions. County commissioners approved two federal grants. Two Bonner County departments have received state and federal grants to fund safety and infrastructure improvements. The airport department was awarded over $400,000 from the FAA for obstruction removal projects at county airports. And then Parks and Waterways received nearly $57,000 to improve docks and add navigation lights at Priest Lake and Lake Ponterey. Both grants require small county matches. In other news, public hearing scheduled for Deerfield Subdivision. I know Sanseray reported on this. The Reader reports that Bonner County Commissioners and Planning Department will hold a public hearing on Thursday, this upcoming Thursday at 1:30 p.m., to consider the preliminary plat for the proposed Deerfield subdivision off Baldy Mountain. The 32-acre project would create 24 lots and has already received a unanimous recommendation for approval from the Zoning Commission. If approved, developers must meet several other conditions, though, including fire and stormwater assessments before the final plat is approved. County will also hold a land use planning workshop next Tuesday to gather input on proposed alterations to the comprehensive plan. And as we've been talking about, you know, kind of the planning and development here in Bonner County, obviously is going gangbusters, and there's been a couple of issues. I know in the past we had kind of talked about the Deerfield subdivision. Is that right?
Sanseray probably talked about that when she was on last.
Okay.
I'm not as familiar with it as she is, although I know that it's starting to become controversial.
Yeah.
We're starting to get letters to the editor about it.
And I know talking to some kids that love to do Frisbee golf, isn't it, in that area?
Yeah.
So sure. Anyway, they're a little bit concerned about that. Also, the Reader reported, and I think that they got this in just at press time, but the Panetta Theater director resigns. The Reader reported that Rob Talbot issued a letter of resignation to the Panetta Board of Directors this week. It ends a nearly two-year run as the leader of the historic downtown theater. Talbot said it's been a great honor leading the Panetta Theater in a statement. And in that statement, he also added it has been made clear that it is time for me to step aside and to allow the board to pursue their vision for the Panetta's future. I remain hopeful that their solutions will be the next step forward for the Panetta. And next, Lightning Creek fire. And so I know that you just got an update on that. But first off, the community members have a chance to get their questions about the Lightning Creek fire answered at a community meeting hosted by the U.S. Forest Service tonight at 7 p.m. at Clark Fork High School. Nothing like a Friday 7 p.m. meeting. Right.
I love those. Those are my favorite kind.
According to the United States Forest Service press release, local fire management and incident management teams will be on hand to provide information on the fire and address specific concerns for the community. It's about 9 miles north of Clark Fork, up the Lightning Creek drainage. And if that sounds familiar, because in 2018, there was a fire in essentially the same place. That fire burned more than 7,600 acres and took months for firefighters to reach containment. And Zach, it seems like it's probably going to take months for firefighters to contain this one. What do you know about it?
Well, I mean, I guess it's kind of hard to say how long I think it'll take. I know that it started, in late July. So it hasn't been burning for too long at this point. It's been displaying moderate activity. That's the word that they use, the fire managers, moderate, quote unquote. But it remains, 0% contained. And as of this morning, when I got the latest update, when we reported on August 7th, that it was 2,400-ish acres, it has now grown to 2,427. So they described that as minimal over the 24-hour period. But yet again, still remains 0% contained. As far as I can tell, and no one's reported anything otherwise, there's no structures in danger. It's pretty rugged, kind of backcountry. But as you mentioned, Will, it is burning on basically the same sort of area as the Cougar Fire in 2018. A lot of dead and down fuel material, like old trees and whatnot, from that fire is now being sort of like recycled into this new fire. In our story that we had, there was a spot fire that started nearby. They got that out really quick. And there was another little fire, I guess it was unrelated, but in the same kind of area across sort of the valley. They got that out, and it didn't even reach an acre. So, I mean, it seems to me like the crews they have there are taking care of business pretty swiftly on anything that might happen around this fire. And because of kind of the weather change that we were talking about, it's gotten a little cooler. We had some rain. We expect more rain, although we also expect some thunderstorms perhaps, which complicates things oftentimes for fire suppression. The fact that it's not like raging up the mountainside, like some of these other fires we've seen around the state where they just kind of explode and become enormous and unmanageable. This fire seems like it's kind of sticking to sort of its little area. And they've got, I think, 97 people on, 97 personnel on it when we reported on Thursday. And then the new report says like 92 or 93. So they've obviously felt that they could take a few people off. It seems to me like they're much more in kind of a management phase, it seems, at this point. Not making any reductions in the acreage, but it's also, as I said, not kind of like spreading out uncontrollably. And it might be due to the landscape itself. I mean, because it's burning on a previous fire scar, that may well be sort of like channeling its activity. Mm-hmm. I'm no fire scientist, but...
Yeah, and I know that you are not a fire scientist, but, when you hear 0% contained, obviously we're kind of trained to be like, oh my gosh, what's going on?
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I've reported on wildfire for, since my Associated Press days back in like 2003. And it's interesting when you really like report on wildfire suppression over the years, how the terminology works. So, I mean, containment, it doesn't mean that, it's uncontained, like that it's like raging across the landscape.
Right.
It's just that they haven't established, sort of hardcore fire lines around aspects of the fire to where it's not going to grow. Like, so they're not promising that it isn't going to grow, but it's also not sort of like, as I say, raging across the landscape. And it's interesting also, kind of the military speak that comes out in reporting on these things. There's like, there's fire lines, there's, suppression, there's resource personnel, stuff like that. So it can be a little bit difficult to kind of cut through some of the jargon to realize that they have this fire sort of in hand, but it isn't officially contained. And they will get there. They always have in the past.
Right, right.
Although that kind of brings us to the other aspect of this is that we have to pay for all this stuff. And the Idaho legislature in the past session in 2025, they reduced the amount of money that we're going to appropriate for wildfire suppression. And in 2024, I think we had $58 million that we ended up spending. This year, they appropriated $40 million. And they've already spent like $9.2 million, which is actually pretty good. Mm-hmm. A lot of the climate scientists and the folks that track this stuff, the fire officials, have warned us for weeks and weeks since the beginning of the summer that because of sort of the weather conditions that we had in the early part of the summer and kind of a dry spring, that we had a higher than average risk for severe wildfire. So I think we were all kind of like prepared for this to be really, really bad. And there have been a number of fires in the state, around the state, like 130 something as of kind of mid-July. But the fact that we've spent $9.2 million out of that $40 million, which is a reduced amount, like I said, suggests that while we have this high risk, we haven't really had to reap the whirlwind so right. far. And, living up here, we're used to, well, unfortunately, now we're used to having a fire season, which we didn't used to have back going to the 80s and 90s when we were growing up. Like, I don't remember a single fire season, quote unquote, growing up
here. Right. Back then, it was the grass burning that was the issue.
Yeah, the people on the Rathdrum Prairie, they would burn the grass, and that would be our big smoke season. But it seems, in the past maybe 10 years or so, we have kind of adjusted to the idea that there's going to be a couple of weeks, maybe even a month or two, where our skies are like super choked with smoke. And that could be from our own local fires, could be from fires in Canada, could be Washington, Montana. But, we have become accustomed to that. And so far this year, and we'll knock on the studio table wood, that we haven't really had those days. I've seen a couple of days where it's been a little hazy, but nothing like, we've seen in some of those past years. So hopefully this remains kind of like the only big fire we have up here. Because when I was looking at the fire map, on Thursday or Wednesday, this was the only major fire in the panhandle. All the other fires that we have operating right now are kind of in this east-west band across the Bitterroot Mountains, sort of north of Lewiston and south of Moscow, extending, from the Idaho side over across the Montana border. And then there's kind of a cluster of fires between Missoula and Helena, which is pretty far afield for us. And we don't tend to get a lot of wind patterns that blow that sort of thing up here. Mm-hmm. It feels to me anyway, like if we're going to get smoke from somewhere else, it's typically going to come from Washington or Canada.
Right.
So far so good. And it'll be interesting to see what comes out of this meeting tonight in Clark Fork. If there's any major updates out of that. And I guess they have a new incident commander now who's going to be briefed on the operations they're doing there. And I guess we'll just have to kind of wait and see and hope that it remains sort of moderate as they have been describing it.
Right. And so with the reduction in the funds that the state allotted, and then also would say a change in administration at the federal level, have you seen any indications that they're kind of taking a step back on some of these fires to let them burn, whereas maybe in the past they would have been a little more aggressive on them?
I don't know that I've noticed anything so far as like a policy shift. My suspicion, when they were talking about this during the legislature, was that it had more to do with kind of like this DOGE government efficiency thing. Mm-hmm. That we were going to reduce expenditures kind of across the board for all these different things. I mean, it's not just wildfire suppression that we've been cutting money out of. Basically every level of government. I'm not sure that there's necessarily a concrete policy to allow fires to burn. I know that there are a lot of people in sort of government and in the fire science community that do argue that we need to let fires burn more actively because it's part of a natural process. And in the case of this fire, the Lightning Creek fire, it was aptly named, right? Because it was started by lightning. So, this was not caused by some, doofus campfire or cigarette butt thrown out of a truck or whatever. So this is, sort of by definition, kind of a natural fire. And I haven't heard a lot of debate this season about that. That debate has been loud in previous years. The discussion that, our land management policies are wrong, that we suppress every single fire, because what you do is, according to this argument, is if you suppress every fire completely, just go and stamp it out, you allow fuel loading for future seasons. Which, a person could argue, and I'm not arguing this, a person could argue that, because this is burning on the exact site as a 2018 fire, that, those fuels were left over from, an active suppression of that fire. And then if those fuels had been burned up completely, then there wouldn't be any, fuel
right
for this fire. Again, I am no fire scientist and I am not advocating one way or the other. That's sort of sketching sort of the broad strokes of what that argument is.
Exactly. And that's the beauty of journalism, especially at like the local level, is that all of a sudden you've got to become an expert or somewhat of an expert on different things. And so let's next transition over to the wastewater reconstruction project or proposal. Yeah. Right, so if we can make that shift, I know it's kind of a different one, but...
It's fire and water.
Exactly.
We have an elemental approach. Yeah,
exactly. Well, we still we can hit on some more there in a few minutes, but... So the city of Sandpoint, and this is something that you've come on and you've done a lot of reporting on, right. And I've been in here as you've kind of discussed the wastewater treatment plant here in Sandpoint, and just kind of what we could probably all agree is a dire need for some work to happen. City of Sandpoint recently asked for some feedback on a potential bond measure that could reach as high as $130 million to reconstruct that aging plant. So in that feedback that the city was looking for, what exactly were they asking residents?
Yeah, so I took the survey myself, mm-hmm. and it's still out there. I actually got an email this morning from the city asking me to take the survey, though I already did.
Yep.
So folks should keep an eye out for that, and they really, really do want people to take this survey. And when I took it, as I recall, the questions were like, you know, how aware are you of this as a problem? How would you rank this as a problem among, you know, other problems? How much would you be willing to pay to, you know, see this fixed? They're proposing, I guess, two different options on this ballot. Well, and I should go back a little bit. One of the questions is, would you even be willing to see this on the ballot as a bond? And if so, would you be willing to pay for the sort of short-term solution? And as I say, they have two different kind of solutions. One is the short-term. It's $80 million. And that would be just sort of the necessary fixes so that we're not, you know, spilling wastewater and, you know, all that nasty stuff into the river. Or would you be willing to go for the full $130 million more permanent solution, which is like a much larger reconstruction, knowing, of course, that this is going to require you to spend a lot more on your sewer bill. And they gave some examples, you know, of how that might look for a person if, you know, should one of the or these either of these options get approved. So for the $80 million option, hypothetically, this is in the survey, hypothetically, if you had a $100 monthly utility bill, it would go to $160 over 5 years. So not all at once, but it would just be a gradual increase. So after 5 years of this bond measure being approved for the $80 million option, your $100 a month utility bill would become $160. If they go to the $130 million option, that $100 in your utility bill would go to $206 over 5 years. So they're asking people to, you know, be honest about, like, is that worth it to you, you know, to have a fully reconstructed wastewater treatment plant? Or is it better to sort of like put the Band-Aids on and then probably, I mean, they don't say this, but
go out again.
But it stands to reason logically that if you don't do a permanent solution, then you're going to have another issue down the road. And previous reporting we've done, you know, we went, Sansere, Mitchell and I took a tour of the wastewater treatment plant last summer with the mayor and some representatives from congressional offices and, you know, Idaho Department of Environmental Quality folks. And I recommend anyone in the city go take a tour of this thing. I mean, everyone should. And not that you want to like distract the workers, but it is so instructive to like actually walk through the facility. I mean, we all know it's there. We all smell it at the festival.
Yep.
So, I mean, we're aware of its existence, but I don't know how many people have actually walked through and looked at how it operates. And my gosh, the equipment that they're working with is literally from the 40s. In some cases. I mean, a lot of that stuff was repurposed from Farragut Naval Station around World War II era. And some of the rooms look like they're from kind of a Star Trek sort of, you know, or like some Cold War, like missile command, you know, like these weird little like blinking lights. And it's all like powder blue sort of steel panels and...
Yeah, like that miniseries Chernobyl, right? Like,
yeah, it definitely, yeah. I mean, I don't know that it's on the level of Chernobyl, but the technology is of the period,
yeah, right,
in many
right.
cases. And the folks who run the plant are, I think, very unsung heroes because the stuff they have to deal with and the way things break there and the lack of budget for, you know, really fixing this stuff. I mean, we were hearing horror stories about, you know, it's like, well, this piece broke and... If it, you know, had been allowed to remain broken, we would have, you know, spilled X amount of gallons of hundreds of thousands of who knows, I mean, how many gallons of, you know, waste into the river. So we had to run out to Home Depot and, you know, get this piece. And then we just kind of slapped it in there and we kept the receipt on it so we could be reimbursed. It's like, oh, my gosh. Like, you know, they were telling us about hoses that break and they have to like run out to like the hardware store and get a new hose. So the fact that we haven't had, you know, sort of like a class 5 environmental disaster out there is entirely due to the people who run the plant. And, you know, one of the things that I was kind of surprised by, not at that particular meeting, but over the course of reporting on it, is finding out that we have like a 10 million gallon overflow. Well, so it's rated for 5 million gallons of waste that it can process. And when we have these rain on snow events, you know, where we all are aware of like how nasty that gets in the winter sometimes when you get a big load of snow and then it rains on it and then it just everything turns to slop. Mm-hmm. Well, at the field where that is, that infiltration and, well, they call it INI, and I forget exactly what it stands for, but it's like basically tons of water infiltrate the system and overflow it. So while we're rated for 5 million gallons, sometimes those INI incidents can raise it to 10 million gallons. So we're almost like we're wow. double the capacity during those times. And there's nothing that we can do about that. I mean, it's nature. Mm-hmm. So there's a capacity issue. There's a equipment issue. You know, some people say that there's a site issue, that the whole plant should be moved somewhere else. And I've heard that argument over the years. And I've heard the counter arguments. And again, I don't have a position on that, but the city seems pretty committed at this point to keeping that where it is and then just trying to rebuild it, you know, on site. So I don't know that that discussion about moving it is going to be one that has much traction going forward. But, you know, the ballot initiative, I think, is the main priority.
Right. So when they get this feedback, I mean, what's if and decide, okay, we do want to go after whatever level of bond. Mm-hmm. What's the process there to get it on the November ballot?
Well, they'll have to write some ballot language. Well, first of all, they're going to have to figure out exactly what the proposal is. Mm-hmm. And they've had consultants working on this for a long time, and they do have sort of plans and schematics and budget projections for a lot of these different things. So I think a lot of sort of like the back end planning, heavy lifting has been done. And the fact that they're even proposing two different options tells me that they have all that stuff dialed in already. So distilling that stuff into kind of concise ballot language, that'll have to go before the city council. They'll debate about it. They'll tweak things, whatever, if they want to. And then once they approve the ballot language, then they have to send that to the county. And the county elections office will certify, you know, that it's going to be on the ballot, and they'll throw it on there. And then in November, maybe we'll see it.
Any sense of a plan B or a plan C or a plan D?
Like if we're not going to do anything?
Right. Well, no, just let's say that it moves forward. Right. And, you know, the appetite on raising taxes mm-hmm. is, you know.
It's never a healthy appetite
yeah, for raising exactly. taxes. So, you know, if they do proceed forward and it just happens to fail, is there any planning there?
It would surprise me if they put it on the ballot at all if they felt like it wasn't going to pass. I think the city was pretty, this is just me speculating. Mm-hmm. And if anyone from the city is listening, you know, this is my opinion, mm-hmm. Is that they were pretty stung by the failure of that 1% local option tax that they put on the ballot, last right. cycle. And that was meant, you know, of course, to deal with another major, issue that we have in the city. And this is another one of our elemental things. This is talking about dirt.
Exactly.
So we have water, fire, dirt. It's like street infrastructure, sidewalks and things, because we just don't have it in our budget, you know, to handle the needs that we have. So the option was, you know, get a local option tax out there and throw a 1% on everything. That failed at the polls. And I think that really kind of was a wake up call to the city maybe. And they're like, oh my gosh, like why would we waste time putting something on the ballot if we know that people aren't going to vote for it, which is why they're doing this survey effort. And I think if the results come back that there's absolutely no interest by the community in doing this, then they're going to have to look for something else. And the only other something else is grants, federal funding, but
and
we
that
don't
apparently seems to be drying up.
Federal right? fund. This is not a good climate for seeking federal funding from agencies. So that's kind of the only thing that we would have left. Like we just need a funding mechanism for this, and short of the community sort of like voting to tax itself for it, you're gonna have to go to those grants and that federal and maybe state money. But again, not a good time to be going out for that kind of stuff. Especially when even some of these departments, you know, like EPA may not even exist,
right.
according to some political operators. So, yeah, this is there's a little bit of a Hail Mary feeling to it, maybe. I don't know. That could be an uncharitable view of it. But I just think that the city really is like, man, we got to deal with this. And this is the way we have to do it. This is the way we have to do it. But, you know, they're asking first just to get that the sense of the interest.
All right. So we got a few minutes left. So we've gone fires. We've gone wastewater treatment, maternal health.
Right.
All right. Go. No, I'm just joking. But the Reader had a package, I think, really well done. Worked with, was it Idaho Capital Sun on that?
Well, Idaho Capital Sun, and I hope by now everybody's familiar with the Capital Sun. It's a nonprofit news organization that's part of a national reporting project called States Newsroom. And they have sort of outlets in different states. And ours in Idaho is the Idaho Capital Sun, based in Boise. And they have a stellar kind of stable of reporters that cover kind of state level politics. And they put this on their website, Idaho Capital Sun, and make the stories available for free to media throughout Idaho, which is incredible. It's like, almost like a wire service that you don't have to pay any money for. So we picked up this piece from Kyle Fannensteel that reports on a JAMA journal report. That showed, kind of put some numbers on what we, I think we all know, is that doctors, specifically like OBGYN doctors, women, or people who work in women's health, reproductive health, those kind of practitioners have fled the state in the wake of our abortion ban, which I think was passed in 2023 or became law in 2023, that essentially levies criminal penalties against providers of abortions. And it had a chilling effect almost immediately on tons of these physicians who work in that sort of field, to where they were like, why would I even work in Idaho at all? And while I think the abortion ban was intended to sort of target that particular healthcare service, it had this, you know, quote unquote unintended consequence of sort of eradicating the entire like obstetrics, like OBGYN women's healthcare field. And Bonner General Hospital, of course, was famously one of the first, if not the first, rural hospital to just shut down its obstetrics unit entirely. Like, there's no babies being born because it's just too risky for the doctors. You know, if something goes wrong with a pregnancy and they have to terminate, you know, to save the life of the mother, they could go to jail. So everyone's like, no, I'm not doing that. so they kind of shuttered that service here locally. And this study has finally kind of come out after a couple of years of being able to track exactly what happened. And it confirms the findings from a report that came out in 2024 from the Idaho Physician Wellbeing Action Collaborative that found Idaho lost 22% of its practicing obstetricians since the state's abortion ban took effect. And then, you know, there's like hundreds of doctors have left. It's kind of what it just kind of confirms, as I say, what we have already kind of known. And what we did was sort of piggyback on that story and localized it a little bit with some of the reactions that we've heard over the past, you know, 2 years from folks.
And I thought that it was really interesting because, you know, besides Bonner General Health shuttering their department, it kind of ties back to this area in regard to the legislators, right?
Yeah, I mean, Scott, former District 1 Republican Senator Scott Herndon was one of the chief kind of architects of Idaho's abortion bans, and also sort of lobbied hard at their party convention even to make it even stricter than it is. I mean, he wanted to get rid of all exceptions, like rape, incest, like there was no reason at all for anyone to ever get an abortion, according to Herndon's stance on it. And he styles himself as a quote unquote abortion abolitionist, which is an extreme form of anti-abortion activism, even extreme within the anti-abortion community. Like there are people who are anti-abortion who are like, whoa, these people are, you know, on the fringe. So that's the space where Herndon comes from. And when we did a candidates forum last year, it was 2024, you know, he sort of poo-pooed this idea that doctors were leaving because of the abortion ban. And this is kind of a consistent argument that you hear from a lot of people on sort of the far right of the Republican Party in Idaho, especially, that, oh, they're not leaving because of that. You know, they're leaving because they want more money. They're leaving because of, you know, career opportunities elsewhere. You know, just you name it. They're leaving for any reason other than this. And they just won't hear that. Congressman Russ Fulcher, our congressional district congressman, representative in the House, he came and did an interview with us in the Reader back in May, and we asked him specifically about this because Fulcher is on the the pro-life committee or something like that. He's made this one of his issues over the years, and we asked him straight up. You know, I was like, well, I mean, what do you think about the fact that we don't have any OBGYNs here? Like, can you speak to that? Like, do these policies force these doctors to not practice, especially in these rural communities? And he, like Herndon, was like, oh, no, that's, well, that's, I need to see the data. Well, here's the data.
Right.
But at that time, you know, he's like, here, I need to see the data. And I just don't think that that's what's happening. And every time we do look at the data, we find that it's a lot of other things. It's very complicated. It's not this. It's something else. And so, again, there's kind of a denial that this is a factor. But this report, of course, is like, no, I mean, this is literally what's happening.
Right.
And we have our own, our current legislators, two of them in District 1. We have our District 1 Republican Senator Jim Woodward and District 1A Representative Mark Sauter. They're interesting on this issue because, you know, Woodward came out in that forum when he was running against Herndon in that primary. And he's like, yeah, we messed up. Like this is messed up. Like what's happening is doctors are leaving because we have this law or these laws and we need to fix it because otherwise we're going to end up with, you know, kind of a rural healthcare desert, which is what the Idaho Democratic Party describes it as. And, you know, a lot of other observers like, yeah, I mean, if you have 37 rural counties that have no OBGYNs,
right,
that is a problem. And so Woodward kind of broke maybe a little bit with the prevailing orthodoxy in his party in even admitting that there was a problem. And obviously voters were like, yeah, okay, because he won and Herndon lost.
Yeah.
And Sauter is also interesting because he initially, I mean, he voted for the abortion law when it came before the legislature, but then came to kind of regret it maybe. And I wouldn't want to put words in his mouth, but he gave an interview with PBS and his Frontline where he kind of was like, yeah, I mean, I did not think that this was going to happen. I didn't think that we were going to lose all of our women's healthcare doctors. I didn't think we were going to lose all of our OBGYNs when I voted for this. So he's kind of moved away from that position. And he and Woodward at the end, very end of the 2025 session, introduced some legislation that would insert exceptions into the existing law. It wouldn't get rid of the law, but it would temper it a little bit with a provision that these procedures could occur. You know, pregnancies could be terminated to protect the life of the mother, which is a phrase that has been controversial in this debate. People like Herndon were like, no, that's not, we don't want to consider that. But Woodward and Sauter both were like, yeah, we need to insert this into the bill. It came at the very end of the session. So
yeah. Can you talk real quick about like the timing and kind of their reasoning for kind of doing this?
So they described it at the time, like they knew it wasn't going to get a hearing. They knew it wasn't going to go forward, but something had to get on the agenda. So they introduced this to start a conversation. And I would presume that means that the conversation will continue, hopefully, at the beginning of the 2026 session. And as far as I know, and I haven't heard anything different from either of them, is that I think they will continue to carry that bill forward in the next session and maybe make that kind of a first sort of order of business. Because since it was the last order of business in the last session. So I think that having this study out there does a lot to make some people feel like maybe they're not crazy.
Right.
You know, because we have people like Jen Jackson Quintano from the Pro Voice Project. She speaks very eloquently and forcefully about this issue. Her organization has become very high profile over the past couple of years since she sort of started doing it. You know, she's been on big speaking engagements. Like she's been interviewed by international news media. And she's like, yeah, these are the numbers. Like this is real. And for people who feel like they have been arguing this for the past couple of years and they get hit with stuff like, oh, no, they're leaving because they want more money. It's like, okay, well, we have the data. Here you go. It's a problem.
Exactly.
And at this point, I think this has been a problem for long enough that I know people and I've had in my own life been affected by this. And, you know, I had a dear colleague whose entire birth plan had to be completely upended because she was like more than halfway through her pregnancy. And she had all intentions of giving birth at Bonner General Hospital. And then this happens. And all of a sudden she has to go to somewhere. I mean, she lives in like East Bonner County.
Mm-hmm.
Like where do you go? I mean, if there's an emergency with this pregnancy, it's from East Bonner County to Coeur d'Alene.
Right.
Yeah. Good luck with that. My own wife, she had a what should and could and was a very routine procedure in Bonner County for decades. She needed to get this done, couldn't do it in Bonner County, so we had to go all the way to Kootenai Medical, which, you know, it's a pain. But coming from Sandpoint to Coeur d'Alene, you know, and it wasn't like an emergency. We weren't like in a terrible condition. So we were like, okay, fine, we'll drive to Coeur d'Alene. So we go there to KMC. The procedure is done. And then we're going to go home back to Sandpoint. Well, there was a complication, which thank God happened there instead of here. So this complication got very serious. Mm-hmm. And we were already at KMC. So that was great. They took care of it. It was an overnight hospital. It was scary. And afterwards, you know, we sat down with the surgeon, and the surgeon was very flat out with me. You know, my wife was still recovering, so she was talking to me. She's like, yeah, I mean, I'm so glad that you guys didn't go back to Bonner County, because if we had done that procedure, you had gone back to Bonner County, and then that had manifested in the night or something. And she was honest. She's like, your wife would have not made it. Like, she would not have survived driving the 45 minutes, because Bonner General would not have been able to deal with that, because they don't have anyone to deal with it. So, I mean, this is real. It's a real thing for people. And we've had a couple of years now of this, and I think it's becoming obvious that, yeah, something probably does need to happen.
Well, Zach, thank you very much for coming in. As always, it's very much appreciated, and learned a lot. And so anyway, any big stories that the reader's working on for the upcoming editions?
Oh, always so much. We're going to have our meeting here in about 15 minutes. I'll know more then.
Okay.
But yeah, there's going to be a bunch of city stuff coming up. You know, we've kind of like not done a lot of city things over the past 2 or 3 weeks. Budget stuff. There's area of impact stuff that's been happening. So expect some more City Hall coverage, I guess, in the next week or so.
Sounds good. Appreciate that you do that. And Julie, I want to thank you so much for coming in today. Hey, Jack, we got this done. And yeah, we went over time.
As always.
We couldn't stop.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, hope you everybody out there has a wonderful weekend, and enjoy the rest of this Friday. And I think we're going to be going into some Wilco. Is that right?
Let's see. Who's up next? The Chieftains.
Oh, the Chieftains. We'll take the Chieftains. Yeah, yes. Yeah. So anyway, thanks for listening.
All right. And here we are. Thanks, everybody, for listening. This is 88.5 KRFY, and we appreciate you being there.